There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At WashableSofas.com, you'll find the Anabay Sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabay has you covered. Visit WashableSofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Hey, y'all, a little bit of housekeeping. Want to make sure you know about our weekend offerings. Over on Bulwark Goes to Hollywood on Saturdays, Sonny Bunch interviews people in the movie business. But this week, there's one that's very relevant to listeners of this podcast. He talks to the director of the documentary, The Sixth, which I really recommend. It takes a different look at the attack, focusing on six stories from that day, and I think highlights the scale of the threat that we faced. Really recommend going to check that out. Also, I'm on the Focus Group podcast, which comes out every Saturday with Sarah. We talk about what's happening with the youth. I don't know if you've given a try to check out the Focus Group podcast to listen to the people. But I just want to say, I think it's a super important part of what we do here at The Bulwark, a super important part of our mission. Allows us to kind of get out of our bubbles and make sure we're listening to people in different demographic groups. You know, this week we're talking to the youth, but Sarah's out there talking to MAGA voters. She's talking to Black voters. She's talking to lefty progressive swing voters. And so I highly recommend the Focus Group podcast out every Saturday. This week you can hear me, but she's got better guests than me other weeks. Lastly, yeah, I'm sad today. Okay. Congratulations to Darla. Any other Minnesota, St. Paul, Twin Cities folks out there, good on you. I'm not ready to take shit talk yet. I'm not ready for that, but life goes on. Good luck to our friends in Minnesota and Dallas. And, you know, it's just sports. It's just sports. We got real business to get to. So up next, friend of the pod, Tom Nichols. Hello and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. It is Monday, but Bill Kristol's in Greece, like, you know, visiting Sisyphus and ruins and such. And so I've replaced him with another curmudgeonly wise man, Tom Nichols, professor emeritus at the Naval War College. He's the author of the Atlantic Daily Newsletter. His books include The Death of Expertise, which now is an updated and expanded edition. And you can get book plates. The book plates are available. Tom, welcome back to the Bulwark Podcast, brother.
Thanks, Tim. Good to be with you, man.
We have an embarrassment of riches today. Well, embarrassment of embarrassments, really. I don't even know if we're going to be able to get to all of them. Luckily, it's a daily podcast, so we can do some tomorrow. But you had MTG. We have Marco, election denial. We have Alito, Mrs. Alito, J.D. Vance. But we have to start with the most embarrassing, America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani. I wrote about him this morning in Morning Shots, where I sat in for Bill. To me, there's some very mockable elements and there's a serious thing. So let's just indulge ourselves in the mockery first. The dude like sends out a tweet with like a selfie with him and some heavily made up, maybe a lot of work done, a lot of women who have updated their look, let's say, where he was taunting the officials in Arizona who were trying to give him a subpoena, saying that they were running out of time to do so. 2 hours later, they did actually, you know, deliver the indictment at his 80th birthday party in Palm Beach. Tom Nichols, what has happened to Rudy Giuliani?
I never knew him. You know, I never knew the guy. I was thinking about this because actually about a week ago, I was at the Mob Museum in Las Vegas, of all places. Very cool place. If you've never been, I recommend it. I then got home and I was actually watching some stuff about the mob. Of course, Rudy is everywhere in these histories. I mean, he's the guy who basically, you know, is one of the key guys in taking down the mob in the Northeast. And thinking about even before he was America's mayor, that, you know, he had this reputation of being tough, no nonsense, you know, straight shooter, kind of a nasty streak to be sure, you know, but nonetheless, not this kind of creepy old party animal who's desperately trying to stay in the public eye. And all I could think of was just how pathetic it was and how quickly he had fallen. I remember a picture of him just before Trump was elected, and he's riding around in a limo, smoking a big cigar, smoking a big heater, you know, in Manhattan. I remember at the time saying, you know, he and these Trump guys always look like they're on their way to foreclose on an orphanage. He was kind of, you know, future master of the universe. Like, all right, he'd hit some hard times. I think Trump just sucks the blood and marrow out of people, you know, as a loyalty demand. I mean, he leaves behind these sad husks of people. And I don't know why. You know, you wrote a whole book about it, about people need to stay in the mix and they need to feel important. But, you know, he's 80 years old. There's no third act here. Yeah. There's no redemption coming. There's no sudden moment where the whole country's going to turn around and say, you know what, Rudy, you were right. We're sorry.
You were right. They were counting the votes incorrectly in Arizona, Rudy. You were the only one that saw it. You were the only one that saw that Ukraine was actually Nazis and corruption, and that it was like Joe Biden was in on
it. You should have been president back in the 90s. We're so sorry. And by the way, here's many millions of dollars to make you whole again. That's not going to happen.
No, it isn't. But he still gets to enjoy himself. As you mentioned, the book, one of the characters, my friend Caroline, I guess we have an interesting relationship, as readers of the book would know. She was the host of that 80th party. And it's like, oh my God, I'm watching all the videos. It's a weird thing. You know, I guess it's like Rudy is singing New York, New York. And, you know, the crowd is like all of these decrepit old guys who are past their prime trying to hold on to this, along with, you know, these younger women.
Including Steve Bannon, who looks like someone destroyed the portrait that he'd been hiding in a closet. And it's catching up with him.
Yeah, and Roger Stone is there. It is such a bizarre thing. But I guess this is how, in this little bubble, right? Is this even true? I guess that's what I'm wondering. In this little bubble, does he still feel important? Is he still getting what he needs? I almost feel like no, because it's the whole thing is kind of sad, right? Doesn't he feel sad?
I've kind of gone past trying to psychoanalyze someone like Rudy, but I was thinking more about your friend who, you know, in a way, this is the coolest party of 2006. Right. It's like if you were a young Republican operative in 2006, you say, hey, I was at this party and it was Rudy's birthday party. And, you know, pre-yikes, Steve Bannon was there and, you know, all these other folks who were up and comers. Right. And I think it's like I finally got to hold the really cool party that would have made me the coolest kid at GOP school in 2009 or something. That's over. That's not. Imagine now going on saying, by the way, I hosted Rudy Giuliani's 80th birthday party. You know, and it's like that line in Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant. And they all moved away from me on the bench. You know? Sure. I hosted Rudy's party and they all moved away from me on the bench. And I don't know. I mean, I think they're trapped in a kind of early 21st century notion of Republican coolness that has long been destroyed by Trump, and they just haven't internalized that.
Maybe. I don't know. I also think it's maybe a countercultural thing. Anyway, we could do a whole episode on this. I thought you were going to do a different Arlo Guthrie reference. I was thinking of coming into Los Angeles, you know, coming into Los Angeles, bringing a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags, if you please, Mr. Customs Man, because that is the serious part of this. We can laugh. Like, the serious part of the Rudy thing, this is what I wrote about in the newsletter this morning, is like, and there was always a little bit of this with Rudy. You know, you go back to, people can Google this, you go back to 92, and there's the plainclothes cop riot that he's part of, you know, because they're upset that Democratic mayor at the time was trying to put limits on the police force, and Rudy's part of that. And so there's always been a little bit of this, you know, for my friends, everything, for my enemies, the law element to Rudy. But like, his brand was fighting corruption, fighting the bad guys, fighting criminals. And if you think of Law and Order Republican, like, Rudy Giuliani is who comes to you in your mind's eye. And for that person to be reduced to taunting law enforcement officials, pathetically, really, you know, trying to be like, na 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 na, boo boo, come, you can't get me, you know, and undermining the rule of law and saying that it's all a fraud and that it's all illegitimate. That is really nefarious shit. And like that, we can laugh at Rudy, but that is the dark side of this, I think.
Well, and that, you know, ducking subpoenas and playing, you know, tag. I mean, normally you just serve a subpoena to your lawyer. And as you say, this was like a game about subpoenas and the rule. And you're right, by the way, just to backtrack for a minute. You know, there are people who will tell you Rudy was always awful. He always had this kind of vicious streak in him. Okay, guy became mayor of New York. Not usually something you get by, you know, being really nice. He wasn't high on my list of favorite Republicans back in the day, but I sort of went with the whole America's Mayor thing. If Rudy had been a prosecutor and they'd said to him, hey, this guy who's involved in a really terrible plan to like upend elections and fake electors and all this other stuff, he's basically told you that you can take your subpoena and cram it with walnuts. You know, imagine how 1998 or, you know, 2004 Rudy would have responded to somebody saying, you know, I got your subpoena right here, pal. And instead, he's that guy now.
And you would have been right back then. He's that guy now. And the tie to me is, have you followed this Texas story at all? And the pardon of Daniel Perry by Greg Abbott. So sickening. So here's the tie for me. And I did a longer rant about this on YouTube if people want to go see that. These guys that, you know, got caught up in this law and order, you know, mindset, which, you know, has some elements to it. I'm not a defund the police guy, but they've gotten so wrapped up in tying it to these culture war fights, right? And like their fight against the deep state and all the MAGA conspiracy nonsense that the Rudy subpoena defying, there's a direct through line between that and Greg Abbott saying, you know, I'm going to pardon this guy who killed a Black Lives Matter protester in cold blood because he's on my side of the culture war, right? You could not possibly imagine the inverse happening, right? Where some liberal comes out and shoots somebody at a MAGA rally and Greg Abbott pardoning them because like, oh, I don't know, it was self-defense or what, you know? And the whole story is fucking sick and absurd. There's no self-defense. The guy drives the truck into a crowd. The other guy's holding a gun legally because it's Texas. And then he takes out his gun and shoots him five times. I mean, like there's no complication to the story. So, but the mindset is the same, right? Which is like law and order isn't for us. Law and order is only for them. That's scary shit. Like, that's not just childish stuff, you know?
Right. The law is merely an instrument of rule. It's not a founding principle of the nation. The rule of law means nothing. It means only what you want it to mean in terms of whether it's to your advantage. And, you know, I can hear conservatives out there saying, well, wait a minute, you know, the left gets into bed with some really ugly people who've really done some bad stuff. And Kathy Boudin and Angela Davis and the whole 70s roster. I think that liberals have this innate distrust of the law and think it's always being misapplied, you know, which is one of my beefs with people on the left for a long time. And that's a legitimate beef to have, right? Do when it comes to things like the death penalty and incarceration rates and racial disparities and convictions. Great. Let's have that argument. This is a totally different argument. This is somebody saying, you know, if I want to troll people and get reelected, I should just pardon somebody who's committed murder because that'll be, you know, hilarious. And the law is merely exists insofar as it is convenient to me. And you're right. That's the scary part, because there is no sense at all that the whole notion of an independently existing rule of law, you know, before which we all must stand and be equal, is just a fiction. It's just an abstract concept that should be discarded if it's to your political advantage to do it.
And then you just think about how things break down and how quickly it could break down and the incentives. You think about a Trump second term, and on the merits, like the pardoning of the January 6th, you know, rioters is bad enough. Like on the merits, it's fucking outrageous and absurd. But to me, the scarier part is the incentives. Like, what does it say to future people that want to commit political violence? If they're looking at this and they're like, well, Greg Abbott, in Texas, they pardoned a guy after he murdered a Black Lives Matter protester. In D.C., of the now new president pardoning everybody that stormed the Capitol, you know, as long as I wear a MAGA hat, I can do whatever I want.
Especially if I'm in the right place.
Right.
Well, my incentives and my fear of punishment vary depending on what state I'm in. you know, for political mayhem.
Yeah.
The other thing to think about with the J6 pardons,
it's like
is
a Balkanized view of our country, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. One of my friends who studies the Balkans, my friend Nick Vozdev, who's a Russia guy, he's like, this is like, you know, the post-Yugoslavianization of American politics. But the other thing he's doing is, you know, Trump's going to create a whole cadre of people whose freedom and whose lives basically came from him. You know, you're going to let a bunch of people who've already done violence on your behalf out of prison with a pardon. And, you know, who do you suppose they're going to be loyal to? What do you suppose their incentive not to reoffend or not to be involved in violence again is going to be? And, you know, it's remarkable to me. I was thinking about this with regard to the OJ trial, right? The same people that back then were jury nullification and, you know, the obvious, you know, and it's like are the same ones now saying, you know what? You know, juries are nonsense. Trump should be out. This is all weapon. These folks in the GOP have become everything they once railed against. They have become exactly who they hated.
No, that literal argument was made to me over the weekend. This some MAGA guy was on social media putting out a bunch of posts about how these bulwark tools don't understand why Daniel Perry needed to be pardoned and a veteran cannot get a fair trial in Austin. You know, and it's just like, what?
Veteran can't get a fair trial in Austin. Oh, all righty.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anabay, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabay sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics. That means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
We had a dueling rallies, I guess. I guess one wasn't a rally over the weekend. Trump spoke to the NRA. President Biden spoke at Morehouse commencement, HBCU in Atlanta. The policy side, I have a clip I want to play that's more in the mocking side of things. So on the policy side of things, Trump goes to this NRA rally and says that he wants to repeal all of the Biden assaults on the Second Amendment, which are like exceedingly modest and supported by 80% of the country. And it's like expanding background checks, closing loopholes, making it a little more complicated for you to get a gun if you're under 21, you know, straw purchases, crackdown with the federal government. And this is not Beto saying, I'm going to come to take your guns type stuff. And Trump, it's interesting. I don't know if this is an example of like Trump just saying whatever the people in the crowd want to hear, which might be as simple as that. But in the past, he had kind of softened his edges a little bit on certain things like this, but he has really kind of fully embraced the right culture war on abortion and guns. And I do wonder if like there's any potential political opportunity for the Democrats there. I don't know what you think.
First of all, I think it's always a mistake to treat Trump as if he has actual policy positions. He is a goldfish who chases food pellets, and wherever he thinks it's advantageous to go, he goes. I mean, abortion's a great case. You know, I'm the guy, I did it. I killed Roe v. Wade. And then, you know, what do you think of these abortion bans? I think they're a bad idea. I think as long as you always remember that he is running for president for narcissistic revenge and to stay out of jail, everything else becomes clear. So really, how do you deal with someone like that who doesn't take his own policy positions seriously? And I guess I don't really know the answer to that, except to keep pointing out that, you know, he is not a stable and emotionally well-ordered person. You know me, Tim. I've been saying for all these years, every time he goes to a rally, just put it on TV and don't do snippets. Don't do either don't cover it at all or put the whole thing on there, because so often the media, and I think, you know, I guess this is a roundabout way of answering your question. I think a lot of times the media says, we're going to take pieces of what he said
you know, like Mad Libs or something, and we're going to reorganize them into something that sounds coherent. And you can't really understand how crazy pants and just how cuckoo it all is unless you hear it all at once. So I kind of don't know what to do with that, because I think he always baits his opponents into saying, well, now we've got him on the issue of abortion. But you don't. He'll just say something different the next day.
It's tough. I agree with all of that on the merits. That's right. I certainly agree with it as media criticism. I do wonder, if you look at the polls, not the top line numbers, but like just the questions of, you know, who do you think you're more aligned with on issues? In 2016, Trump was seen as more moderate than Hillary. I know a lot of people think that's crazy, but he was, by voters. I think it's because he was heterodox on Iraq and on Social Security and Medicare. Again, you can say, well, all that was bullshit. Was he really heterodox? He just like spews bullshit. True, granted. But the perception in voters was that he was more moderate than Hillary. It was the inverse in 2020. And this time it's back to voters thinking Trump is more, I don't have the poll in front of me, so I don't remember the exact language, whether it was moderate or more mainstream.
You had the New York Times piece yesterday saying Trump is part of a new centrism.
Who said that?
Tim, bro, I wouldn't lie to you. Here's a quote. I kind of wrote this down because I was trying to sort of, you know, figure it out. And the quote was, then there is Donald Trump. He is in some ways part of the new consensus, but he is also hostile to basic democratic traditions, including an independent judiciary and the peaceful transfer of power. If he becomes president again, his promised agenda is sufficiently extreme that it may chill bipartisan cooperation. I mean, you do have people, you know, in the media out there in the world saying, yeah, he is moderate. He is David bipartisan.
Leonhardt. Yeah.
But that's because he changes his mind every other day. I think when he gets out there and he really gets his head of steam up and, you know, crows about killing Roe v. Wade, then Democrats, I think, have all they need to make their case against him. But it's very difficult with a guy who without. It's funny we're talking about this because I'm going to be writing later today about the Republican memory hole, how, you know, no one seems to remember anything they ever said. But, you know, what do you do with the guy? Say, yes, I'm totally against abortion. Are you? No. Would you ban it? Yes. How quickly would you ban it? Well, I wouldn't ban it. You can't talk to someone like that. I don't want to tar anybody with the wrong byline. Someone years ago wrote that Trump has defeated the traditional political interview. Because there's no shared reality with the interviewer and there's no sense of a common narrative that you actually have a position you're putting forward. It's just kind of a big game to see how many points you can score.
Yeah, and Jonathan Swan was really the only one to break him on that. And it was just, I think COVID was a big part of it because there were a lot of facts related to what was happening with COVID that he was wrong about. I just would mull on this for a minute. We can revisit it. We got 5 months. And I think this is obviously something the Biden campaign is thinking about. But I agree with you on the merits that he's nonsensical. I guess what I would say is the people that have assessed that Trump is a crazy person, that you can't trust anything that he says, they're already in the tent here. Okay. So the question is, are we reaching the other people by calling him a crazy person again? Maybe not. And maybe a more compelling thing is for Democrats to be a little bit more aggressive. They're already doing this on abortion, but across a range of issues take a culture war fight back at him. Because I do think that he has embraced in a way that he hadn't in 2016, some extreme views.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And so if you're saying, even though what he's saying is gobbledygook, if you're running a campaign that's like, this guy wants to make it illegal for women who have ectopic pregnancies to have an abortion in certain states. He wants to make it easier for people under 21 to get guns and reopen the gun show loophole. He wants to deport 11 million people and have camps in Texas. I think that trio of issues, which have been strong Republican issues in the past, like framed like that, that has like 20% support, maybe 10% support. People that are like four teenagers having guns, four deportation camps, and four banning abortion at 2 weeks. Like that's a pretty unpopular basket of issues.
And an important part of that is that once you've adopted those positions, you know, now I'm going to argue against my own point. Years of being a professor make it easy to do that. Once you've adopted those extreme positions, it's pretty hard to unring that bell later. He had the room in 2016 to say, well, maybe, I don't know. We're strongly looking at it. We're looking at it strongly. We're strongly going to look at strong looking. But now he doesn't have that presumption anymore. He doesn't have that wiggle room anymore. First thing I thought of when you brought this stuff up is wow, there's still an NRA after all that. You know, Trump talks to the NRA, says crazy stuff. The buried lead, like, wow, the NRA still exists after all this, you know?
That's a good point. All the progressives who are like, we haven't gotten anything. We never do anything. Like, you know, the country is going, it's kind of like, well, there are some wins out there. Here's another example of a win, just how weak the NRA is, the fact that these reforms got passed. Anyway, I want to play one more clip from the NRA. And it's going to be a little painful. I'm just going to warn you. It's going to be a little painful. But to make the point, we're going to need to listen to all of it. So here was Donald Trump at the NRA.
Nation in the history of the world.
I want to point out that we're in the middle of the speech right now. I want people that are not on YouTube that are listening just envision Donald Trump staring right now at the crowd. Interlude is still going. He's now shaking his head a little bit.
But now, we are a nation in decline.
What the fuck?
You doggy.
It is so weird. This shit is so weird. Yeah. It is the QAnon music and the talk of American decline is effective.
You know, we only had the audio, but I could see people swaying with their hands in the air, you know, like it's a tent revival. I mean, you know, it's a cult, and whoever's stage managing this knows exactly what they're doing, that this is all an appeal to raw emotion and, you know, the swelling music and all of that stuff. I mean, it's on the one hand, it's like, you know, again, both of us sitting here going, what the hell was that? But, you know, for a lot of people, this is like a religious experience for them. And what's really striking about it, and I know I've said it before, but I can't help but say it again. This is a, you know, Wagnerian kind of cultishness that's built up around this sad little boy from Queens, this like, you know, weird, blinged out, you know, outer borough mook. I mean, it's amazing. And it shows that if you really do it right, you can create a cult around anybody.
Well, not anybody. I don't think Ron DeSantis or Ted Cruz could have had a cult, but
All right. Well, you've got me there, Sonny Jim. You know, but yeah, I mean, you can create a cult around almost anybody, especially if they have this kind of narcissistic sense of self-importance. Or it's really, I listen to this and I think, wow, people are swaying and this music's playing and the guy there in front of is Donald Trump. It's like a Simpsons episode.
Yeah, a down market Simpsons episode. I kind of want one of our friends in Hollywood, one of the pod friends, Rob Reiner, or somebody to do just like a 1 minute cut of like Donald Trump standing up there with the weird QAnon music on one panel and the other panel is like the cops getting mauled. Like, you know, like at some point, don't people have just be like, this is too weird of a fucking cult for me. All right. I just can't do it.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anabay, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabay sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics. That means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
One more Trump thing before we get to, you know, his various little hangers-on. You were invoked in Friday's podcast. I don't know if you know that, towards the end.
I felt tingling with power at a moment, so I knew it must have.
We were discussing a disagreement, an intra-never-Trump disagreement. I, Joe Walsh, and we're talking about how Jonah Goldberg had said, you had a long interview with Jonah, and he was wondering why people like you and me are such cheap dates.
Yeah, that's Jonah's line, isn't it? It's like, why are you a cheap date? And it's like, come on.
Yeah. Well, I don't mean to pick on Johnny Good, but we did that on Friday, and we're using this because he's representative of a lot of people. Actually, in the bulletin this morning, Caputo is writing about how there are many other people who are making the same point, that maybe not many, but at least a significant portion of rich donors who don't really love Trump, but they want Biden to give more on Israel or else they'll flip teams. I find this preposterous, as I've said many times. Like, you wrote for The Atlantic a couple weeks ago about how people have a failure of imagination about Trump and the next term. And it seems to me like that is the answer to why we are cheap dates, right? Like, if you truly believe that the threat is that risky, then like little disagreements over exactly what weapons Israel should have, as important as that is, kind of pales in comparison to the threat. That's at least my answer, but I'm curious how you would talk about that.
One is that I think for some folks, and I don't include Jonah in this, who I think, you know, is a fair broker and I respect him and we had a good conversation about it. But I do think there are people who want to vote for Trump for a whole lot of reasons, including, you know, just because they think it's just a way to stick it to people they don't like. And so they are reverse engineering reasons for stuff they were going to do anyway. Right. If someone says, well, you know, I wasn't going to vote for Trump, but I don't know, this Israel thing, I mean, give me a break. You know, first of all, foreign policy is almost never the deciding issue in a presidential election. Probably not since 1984.
Maybe 04.
Yeah, maybe in 04. But even there, if the war were going that badly, Bush wouldn't have won a bigger share. I mean, in the end, people vote on, you know, their perceptions of the economy, whether they like the guy in office. Usually, and there's a great line about Afghanistan, by the way, that I used in the piece I wrote about Afghanistan, where a political scientist said, you would have to have an electron microscope to find the influence of Afghanistan in any congressional level elections over the past 20 years. So, you know, when somebody says, well, I don't know, you know, look, that what that means is I was probably going to vote for Trump anyway, but I know it's about as socially acceptable in my circle as smoking in church. So now I have a reason that I can do. Now, with the other issue about cheap dates, I think there's a fundamental error in the way Jonah and other folks have approached people like you and me. I'm not a cheap date. I don't agree with Democrats about a lot of things. But on the other hand, if I have to let one party or the other control a really important issue, if I had to say, well, would I rather have a less restrictive abortion regime under the Democrats in a way that makes me uncomfortable? Or would I rather have, you know, these kind of mean-spirited theocrats handling it among the Republicans? That's not a hard choice for me. I mean, that's, you know, I'm in the great big middle of America, which is, I think abortion has to be legal, but I think there have to be some restrictions. And I think, you know, people of goodwill have to figure it out. But I can live with bad policies on guns or other, you know, other matters. What I can't live with is a constant attack on the Constitution and the rule of law. We're not really cheap dates. We're not really just signing on to everything Democrats want and saying, you know, oh, yeah, everything's. I called Cori Bush and, you know, AOC the other day, and boy, they've just got my head back on straight about socialism. You know, that's not happening. But if my choice is, you know, fuzzy headed socialists versus autocrats who want to torch the Constitution, once again, where's the real choice here? And so I've always thought that was an unfair argument to make against people like you and me, that somehow we have just signed on wholesale. Yes, well, you know, open the borders. You know, I've had a new revelation. Bring them on.
Also, that's not happening. You know, give us a serious alternative and then we'll start to make a serious, you know, consideration again between the policy sides. But that's not what's happening. You made the point about the fuzzy-headed socialists versus the autocrats. I have a line that I've used several times about how, like, if you're forcing me to choose between Sweden and Hungary, like, it's not a tough choice for me. Like, yeah. It's just not. Like, Sweden is fine. It's not my ideal policy, rubric, right. But it's fine. And to that point, that choice is different for the Republicans. Let's take a listen to Hungary's biggest fanboy, J.D. Vance, on the Sunday shows this weekend.
Well, America's universities still attract talent from around the world, as you've went to one of America's very top schools.
Look, there are still good things about American universities, but it's going in the wrong direction, Margaret.
But Viktor Orban in particular, as you know, I mean, he rewrote the Constitution. He neutered the courts. He has tried to control the media. These are not necessarily conservative principles. So why would you want to mimic him?
Well, look, I'm not endorsing every single thing that Viktor Orban has ever done. I don't know everything he's ever done. What I do think is that on the university principle, the idea that taxpayers should have some influence and how their money is spent at these universities, it's a totally reasonable thing. And I do think that he's made some smart decisions there that we could learn from the United States.
A lot to learn from about how the feds can take over our university system. We could, America U, a lot to learn from Viktor Orban.
You know, J.D. Vance, of course, I've written about J.D. Vance and have added some of my own spicy description of him. But, you know, the thing about J.D. Vance is both that he knows better, because he is smarter than that, but that he is this kind of giant walking lightning ball of resentment. You can just hear it about, you know, those kids at the universities and like clubs that he feels that somehow he was never a part of, even despite having a, you know, Ivy League law degree. And you see that with other guys, with Bannon, with Stefanik, with others who, you know, are not only know better, but that just have this kind of sneering resentment of an elite to which they aspired and yet felt that they were kept out of. And that's, I think, what makes them so just cringe inducing, because you listen to Vance talking about the Hungarian model. And I love that. Well, I don't know all the things he's done. You know, that very very lawyerly thing there about, well, you know, he's done, oh, I didn't know that. You know, he's always left himself that trap door, but well, I didn't know about all the bad stuff. Yeah. It's embarrassing. And once again, you know, it raises an issue to go back to Jonah's, you know, comment about getting on board with people. It's not a matter of getting on board. It's a matter of trust at this point. When I was a Republican, I sort of trusted that we were kind of the boring party. Where I grew up, Republicans were boring. We were the land of these moderate New England Republicans, Olympia Snow and, you know, Ed Brook and all these other folks. But I trusted that, you know, that generally speaking, the Constitution and the law, just a more sensible group of people. I just don't trust the Trumpist party. I mean, I don't trust that anything they're doing doesn't have an agenda of basically, as you've been pointing out for this past hour, you know, basically just destroying the Constitution, pardoning their friends, and using the weaponizing the law to kind of institute minority rule. You know, that's a really important issue. I don't trust anything J.D. Vance says, because I don't think he believes a word of it either.
Well, there's one other branch of the government where this is happening. We have to talk about Mrs. Alito. Yes. We have to talk about Mrs. Alito. I need to know what Tom Nichols thinks about Mrs. Alito. It's really something.
I just don't understand why these conservative Supreme Court justices have wives that seem to keep them out of the loop about everything they're doing.
It's like, you know,
wow.
I don't know how it works in your house, but usually if a flag gets inverted on your front porch, is that something that you noticed, you think, or you just would kind of...
And, you know, if my wife were exchanging emails with seditionists, I think I'd probably notice. I mean, I don't
come up at dinner.
I don't really pry deeply into every aspect of my wife's friendships and her personal life. But, you know, we are married. We do share a home. I think I would probably notice the seditioning and the upside down flags and the. It's amazing how fast Alito and Tom just offload this stuff. But you know, women, what are you going to do? You know, they're emotional. First, they're padding around the house with their bunny slippers, and the next thing you know, they're hanging flags upside down.
They're trying a coup. You know, you'd think the coup would come up during pillow talk in the Thomas household. The whole story, though, is also just preposterous. And Alito's never really denied it, even in the Fox News, you know, kind of revamp the view from the Alitos, where they're like, well, I mean, what really happened here is that somebody down the street had an F Trump sign and they called Mrs. Alito the C word. And I was like, okay. But then why was the flag upside down again? I mean, if the story was like Sam Alito was out in his boxers shouting down a neighbor, like, okay, that would be also a little weird for Supreme Court justice, but that would make sense. That would be a sensible reaction to a neighbor calling your wife the C word. Flipping the flag upside down and doing a January 6th, you know, kind of signal, a signal in support of the January 6th insurrectionists. I don't understand how that follows from being called the C word.
Don't you see what we made them do?
Yeah.
See what we made them do again. Yeah. You know,
the one liberal on the block.
Yeah, right. My favorite part of the story was, well, she was just upset because the kids could see it on their way to school. Well, except it was during COVID. There was no school. The bus stop was empty. Tommins just adopts this kind of imperial silence, you know, of like, I'm not here to answer your questions and I'll be here until I die. And that's your problem. That's a you problem, not a me problem. Yeah. But Alito is so thin skinned that he really just has to fire back, and he's got stories and he needs to tell you. And, you know, I think you're absolutely right that if somebody comes by and calls your word, you know, or says, F you say, you know, old street guy, right? F me, F you, pal.
Right. Yeah, you know, sure.
But you don't say, oh, fuck me. Well, that's it. Now I'm going to hang a seditionist sign out in front of my house.
I think the revealing part of all this with these guys is that if they really believed their own BS about this country and how they love the country and the Constitution and their devotion to it, then like they would be at least equally as mad at the people that were storming the Capitol, raising Confederate flags and slinging shit inside the Capitol and trying to stop the peaceful transfer of power as they are about the guy down the block who doesn't like Donald Trump. Right? Like you would think that they would be upset at that, but they don't seem to have that same rage.
Well, you know how allergic I've been to using the word fascism.
I do.
You know, but I did write about Trump finally crossing that line. And I think one other thing that I think is a really worrisome sign here is that with authoritarian, let's call it authoritarianism for now at least, one thing about authoritarian movements like this, they are not anti-elite. They just think the wrong elite is in charge.
Yes.
And they want to be that new elite. You know, they're like, no, no, we must have decorum. We must have the rule of law. We must have order as long as it serves my purposes. If not, then all bets are off until the offending elite is removed from power and disgraced and pushed out. And then we come back in and we say, now we shall reestablish, you know, peace and order and decorum. And I think one thing people don't understand is that, and this came up, you know, in the unfortunate Marjorie Taylor Greene chaos moment.
Oh, great. I was going there next anyway, so go ahead.
Is that you don't preserve the rule of law and the decorum of institutions and the sanctity of those processes by deciding to, you know, get in the mud and wrestle. And Alito, I think, I mean, in a way, I'm glad Alito did it because, you know, the mask is off. But I still maintain that for the rest of us, a kind of fidelity to principle, to the rule of law, to a certain amount of stoicism, definite amount of decorum is the way you undermine this. Because part of what's happening is all of these people, whether it's Alito or Green or anybody else, they are encouraging the notion that these elites who must be replaced, these terrible people who run the country, they're all the same. And none of us are any worse than them.
Yeah, it's like we did bad things too. It's back to that old Trump line, you know, about...
We're killers.
Yeah, we're killers too. Right.
What Green wanted to do was draw the foul. Watch this. I'm a terrible congressman. I can make other people be terrible members of Congress too.
So for context, for people that may have missed it, and God love you if you did, what Tom's referencing is that at one of these stupid, completely pointless House oversight hearings where they're like going through impeachment theater where they're pretending they might impeach Joe Biden at some point, even though they don't have any evidence or any impeachable misdemeanors or high crimes. They held an evening session, which is maybe a mistake to hold evening sessions in Congress. I don't know what these guys are doing. Maybe happy hour might have been happening in Congress. They held the evening session because it's important to state that some of the members of the committee were up in New York doing another show outside the Trump trial in Manhattan. And so they moved the morning session of this hearing to the evening. And so during it, Marjorie Taylor Greene criticizes or attacks Jasmine Crockett over fake eyelashes. And then AOC and Jasmine Crockett, she's a Democratic congresswoman from Texas that I think is going to be on the pod this week. So we can pre-butt your concerns about her and I can relay them to her, Tom. But she pushed back that Marjorie Taylor Greene has a bleach blonde, bad built butch body. Or was it botched body? Butch body?
Butch.
I think butch body.
That was butch.
That's funny.
And it's a human funny thing to do.
But you, and there was a lot of yes queen kind of feeling on the internet. I have to admit that I participated in that. But Tom, as is your style, kind of, you know, wanted to warn everybody that maybe you were actually helping Marjorie Taylor Greene by this. So you were kind of getting to that, but expand on that point a little bit.
Representative Crockett did it's a very human thing. I mean, I think AOC's one about just yelling, oh, baby girl, you know, I was like, okay, oof. What Crockett did was kind of clever where she didn't address her remarks to Green and she asked the chair, you know, if I said that, would it be bad? Right. Green's point is to convince people who aren't really paying attention to politics. Look, we all suck. We're all terrible and none of us are better than the others. And I can prove it. I know it sucks to always have to be the grownups. It sucks to always have to be the people that are speaking in measured voices. And I know everybody wants to punch a bully. But I just think that, you know, Green is a troll. She's trying to draw the foul.
She's trying to turn the meeting into chaos. I was laughing when you were talking about night sessions. I'm like, yeah, you know, maybe we shouldn't have these kind of like the, it's like the after dinner break episodes of the old Match Game. You know, there's a deep cut for people from the 70s, you know, where they used to take a break and then kind of all wander back in tired and after dinner and a few drinks. Maybe nighttime sessions are never a good idea, but you know, good idea or not, I think that the only way to embarrass people like Green is with kind of an embarrassed silence and a quick ruling and you move on. Green was never weaker, by the way, than when she tried to kick Johnson out of the chair. And everybody said, yeah, whatever. Motion defeated. Moving on.
Right.
You could tell that that pissed her off. She got no real video out of it. No real moment. No virality. You know, it was like, I demand the chair be vacated. And like the whole Congress went, okay, thank you for your interest in national government. We're moving on now.
It's a fair rebuke, Tom. Okay, we're going to end with the mailbag, but I want to talk about an article you have before we get to a final mailbag question. You wrote a beautiful dedication to your late cat, Carla, called The Cat Who Saved Me. As I mentioned, the Green Room, not a big cat guy. I didn't read it because I was like, I don't know if I'm going to feel the same feelings and the same emotion that you have about the late cat. But I have to tell you, it was really moving. It was extremely well done. People should read it. And you can talk about Carla if you wish. But there was one part of the dedication that I'm really curious to ask you about. We'd love to hear some wisdom about. You begin it by writing, I was divorced, broke, drinking too much, and living in a dated walk-up next to a noisy bar, which is a good lead into a to an epigraph or to a joke, I guess.
Greek-Irish guy walks into a bar. Yeah.
But it's interesting. Like, this was in my periphery of knowledge about your life story, you know, but I didn't have the full context of what was happening with you. As I'm getting into my 40s, I have a lot of friends and I hear from a lot of people who are kind of in that place in their life where they're middle-aged or approaching middle age, and they feel a little stuck, and they feel like life didn't go the way they wanted exactly, and they had the good life, but you know, maybe not as good as their peers, or something. They hit a road bump. They feel like, man, it's too late to kind of, you know, turn over a new leaf and do something else new. And so, I actually am interested in hearing you talk about that a little bit, because you know, look at you now, you're crushing it.
Well, thank you, Tim. You know, first of all, I think in general, as an overall observation about life, your 40s generally suck.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
No, I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, like in your 20s, right? You're still in college. You're getting your career started. You have all these rooms to make mistakes. You're still totally, I mean, when I was in college, I had a 31-inch waist.
Oh, man. Send me some pictures of that, Tom. Well, you know, I might have a different view.
Hey, man, I could wear the skinny jeans. You know, I was a skinny guy. I was in good health. And then in your 30s, you know, you're sort of climbing the mountain a little bit, and you know, relationships are settling in, and you're not dating anymore. You're getting married. You're trying to make a go of it. And your 40s are when you start to age. You know, and really notice it. Maybe that's when it starts to creep up on you, as you just said. You know, like your friends say, hey, you know, maybe a lot of things like the way I thought life was going to go isn't going to work out the way I'd planned. In my case, I had a lot of what the Navy would call hits below the waterline. You know, I just took a lot of torpedoes. Well, I had a very amicable divorce, I will say. You know, my ex-wife's a wonderful person and we co-parented well together. But I wouldn't wish divorce on my worst enemy. I mean, it's one of the most painful, horrible things there is. And, you know, it came with a lot of financial upheaval and, you know, I was trying to take care of two homes and make sure that my daughter was okay. My daughter was just very little at the time. And, you know, of course, there I was saying, oh, I'm a divorced dad and I've screwed up. You know, my daughter is now healthy, happy and in college. But, you know, 15 years ago, you say, oh, I've completely screwed everything up. You know, I took this big run at my career. I'd already had a big career hit when I had to leave Dartmouth because after this bruising, bloody 10-year fight. And then I became a government employee and taught at the War College. And as I say in the piece, the apartment had a beautiful view of the Newport Harbor. So that was like a good reason to take it. But, you know, I find myself sitting there saying, what the hell did I do? You know, how did this happen? And how much of this responsibility taking am I really comfortable, you know, with self-examination? Because that's the other thing you say. I think a lot of people get to that point and say, oh, I was dealt a raw deal, man. No, no, I sat there and saying, boy, did I make some really stupid moves. But I will tell you, Tim, even though you're 40s, my 50s were the best time of my life.
and my 60s aren't turning out to be so bad either. You know, it passes. And I think actually I'm going to say there is data that actually tracks with this, that most people say life satisfaction in their 40s kind of dips. It's when you're letting go of all the expectations from those great years when, you know, like I said, when you had a 31-inch waist and you were still coming out of school. And then my 50s were just awesome. But I got this cat because, you know, instead of just walking around my apartment, suddenly there was this cat saying, "Hey, I'm hungry. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, here's a mouse." "You have mice, by the way." You know, she caught a live mouse. That was such a great day. And she always trapped them alive. And we were laughing because, you know, it was in the wall. Yeah. And I was like, "Okay, you've caught a terrorist infiltrator in the house, you know." And I picked it up and I brought it outside. And rather than be interrogated, Mousy Bin Laden jumped out of my hands and jumped off the roof. And I was like, "Wow, Carla, you didn't do that. I did." And then she would strut around as if she invented being a cat. So, you know, suddenly it takes you out of yourself. There's this other little living creature who says, "You know, I don't want to sit around while you mope. I want to watch some TV, or let's eat something together, or, you know, play with me, do something." And I think it really, especially with that cat's personality, which was very present, very, you know, sort of imperious, like, you know, "Good morning. It's time for you to pay attention to me." It really helped to pull me out of just spending too much time in my own head. But yeah, you know, your 40s, I don't wish this on anybody. I hope other people in their 40s are having a great time. But you go through a divorce in your 40s, and I had another relationship with a very nice person that didn't work out. So I was just kind of sitting there thinking, boy, I'm just not good at any of this right now.
Well, I love that the cat helped you. But yeah, no, my big takeaway of it is I just think that this is the narcissism of everybody, every stage in life. You know, you don't think about old people's lives that much, right? And so it's just like a lot of people I see that are going through what you're going through are like, "Man, it's too late to like fix anything." And it's kind of like, you must look back at that and just be like, you've lived a whole life since, like a whole nother life since all that happened, you know?
My wife and I had that conversation yesterday that the past, I don't know, 12, 14 years, is shortly after this, I met my wife and we started to date, that it's almost like it's been an entire other lifetime. And no, it's never too late. If anyone out there is dealing with depression, you know, it's never smart to say, "Oh, just cheer up." You know, it doesn't work that way. Yeah. But that life is cyclical. And the idea that, you know, if you're 45 years old and it's too late, you got a whole other life that could be lived. And that's through luck and friendship. And as I say in the piece, if you have a good doctor and a good priest, in my case, a good doctor, a wise priest, a good counselor, you can get through a lot. But if you have all that and a good cat, you can really cover a lot of ground.
All right. Well, everybody should read The Cat Who Saved Me. Tom, I'm going to keep you. We're already long. That's okay. We're going to do one mailbag question. So mailbag people, you can email us bulwarkpodcast@thebulwark.com. The readers of the mail have asked for me to let you know that just like when you're at a public event where you're asked to ask a question, it's best for questions to end with a question mark. And many of the people who have written in, God love you, have written very long essays, which we like to read about their opinions about various things. That's nice. But a long essay about something ending with thoughts, question mark, is not actually a question. So please, shorter questions, help the hamsters that make all this work get through them a little quicker. And there's one exception to this. We are still taking life advice. That can be longer because, you know, I need the full context. But questions should be short questions. All right. We're doing just one today, but Bill Kristol's gone. And so we're doing this one in honor of him. The loudest listeners on our Substack and on Reddit and all these various places do not like it whenever Bill Kristol talks about how Joe Biden needed to move on. Okay. They do not. They're sick of Bill Kristol talking about that. But the private mailbag reveals the truth because many private mailbaggers have emailed like Jim did. Is there anything we as voters can do to pressure Joe Biden to drop out and put the country over his own ego before we are living in the dystopian nightmare of a second Trump term? So with Bill Kristol in absentia, Tom Nichols, how do you answer that question?
My answer to that is I actually wrote a piece for The Atlantic a while back to say, look, the GOP would like nothing better than a Democratic primary because it would instantaneously get ugly. It's too late for this now, but if Joe Biden, let's just play it out. If Joe Biden had stepped down, first of all, Kamala Harris is the obvious heir, and she has to be simply because, you know, by virtue of being the vice president, right?
We should just say also, and the fact that she's a black woman makes it very hard to displace her, I think, you know, for certain types of candidates. Maybe that's wrong, maybe whatever. Everyone can have their opinion on that, but I just think that's a reality of the on the ground.
And that's exactly what would have happened. There would have been a gigantic shitstorm of everybody saying, if she were going to get defeated in this primary, you know, how racist is the party? Why do they hate women? Right. The better arguments about her numbers are actually worse than Biden's would not have mattered to anybody. And the Democrats would have gone into full, you know, traditional Democratic Party behavior that would have been to the glee of the GOP and the whole right-wing ecosystem. But the other answer that, other than just being an old guy who sounds old, I've said many times, what exactly in Joe Biden's record would make you say that he has to step down? And I'm looking at this as a political scientist. I'm looking at this as a, you know, observer of politics. If you took Biden's name off of his record, you have a record that almost any president would want to run on. This isn't Jimmy Carter. And even Carter didn't get displaced. I mean, Carter had a genuinely dismal record of, you know, an economy in free fall. The Soviets are running roughshod over us. They're in Afghanistan. They're flipping us the bird on nuclear weapons and a disastrous failed rescue attempt in Iran, right? A military failure on top of everything else. And even Ted Kennedy couldn't displace Jimmy Carter. You just don't do it. It's not like Joe Biden's health is failing. He talks funny when he's taught, you know, he's like, he's an old guy. He talks like this. He walks funny because he has a bad ankle. Christ almighty. You know, if that's the bar for replacing him, then I don't know, you know, who can survive into a second term. So I understood Bill's point. I think any other Republican would probably be cleaning Biden's clock at this point, simply because we are a country that runs on vibes and optics now. But the idea that a president steps down, you know, by that reasoning, Reagan should have stepped down in early 83.
Yeah, I mean, my view on this, I have always been kind of in the middle ground, because I just think I was so wrong in 2016 that I try to have much more humility about my political predictions. And it's kind of like, who knows, right? I don't know. Maybe there's something about Biden's age and the way he presents that is harming him such that changing would have helped. There's no evidence of that in the data, but maybe it would have. But my thing is, like, a lot of times the people that suggest this, so you mentioned the Kamala Harris shit show and how race and gender would have been just inserted into all of this. That's one element. But also, I throw out, you can't see the future, you don't know what's going to happen. Think about the Israel shit show. Like, if Joe Biden was presidenting right now, and then you have a Democratic primary where some of these people are incentivized to criticize Biden on the other side, right? Like, and so you have at least some candidate that would be in this thing that is saying, we should stop giving all arms to Israel. Israel's committing a genocide. Our fracture in the party is even more exacerbated because there's a sitting president trying to do one thing and a primary trying to do another. So I think a lot of times people that suggest this don't think about all the downstream, you know, they just imagine that their favorite Democrat replaces Biden and it's clean, right? You know, and they don't think about all of the other stuff.
And the one thing we know historically is an incumbent party that has a challenge to the incumbent president is the party that loses.
Well, Tom Nichols, thank you for your wisdom. Thanks for coming back, fighting through a cold on the Bulwark Podcast. We'll be seeing you again soon. We'll be back here tomorrow. It should be a fun one. Talk to y'all then. Peace.
Baby, you know I'll always tell you straight. Make sure you're well equipped to navigate the world and its lies. So baby, don't cry. I love the way you are my open book. I see your innocence in every look. You're my sunshine. I feel music in your life. When I hold you in my arms, I feel your soft breath. See you close your eyes and watch your head rest right next to mine. Your precious little heart makes up for when I've had my bullet part. Now I've tried to give you a much better start in this life. Connor, look what you've done to me. You
Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? WashableSofas.com has your back. Featuring the Anabay Collection, the only designer sofa that's machine washable inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slipcovers made with performance fabrics. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Check out WashableSofas.com and get up to 60% off your Anabay sofa, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.